You're listening to a download from the outdoorstation.co.uk.
Number 356. Hello and welcome back to the Outdoor Station. And welcome to part three of my series where we continue to discuss the ultralight backpacking market with some of the key players in the US cottage industry who have helped shape what it is today. In my previous two episodes, I spoke with Ron Moak of Six Moon Designs, looking at his brand and product development over the years and reflections on the current lightweight movement. Henry Shires will be a name and a brand well known to many around the world. Henry, an enthusiastic outdoors person, started the business manufacturing lightweight shelters and has stayed true to his central core ever since the first one was sold way back in 1999. As with Ron, I started by asking him if general interest in the lightweight movement had been noticeably waning or increasing in recent years.
Well, I don't think the lightweight movement has gone anywhere but up in the last 3 or 4 years. And you can kind of see that by what's happening with some of the, what I would call the big box manufacturers. I think there's more and more push toward bringing down the overall weight of tents anyway for a lot of manufacturers who are not traditionally known for lightweight gear. And so I think they've seen the writing on the wall, or at least the trends, and they've tried to produce toward that. I think what's happened in the last 3 or 4 years is, you know, there's been more and more interest in some of the higher tech, if you want to call it, or very lightweight materials that are also at the same time very expensive. So, you know, by that I mean the carbon fibers, the Cuban fibers, the stuff that's really aimed at very, very lightweight replacement materials for what has worked for many of us, you know, for a long time. For poles and fabrics to make the same thing happen. So you're seeing some of the bigger box, you know, moving into stuff that was kind of where we were a few years ago, and then trying to do it on a little bit more of a mass production scale. I suspect that it's still niche for them. I mean, the costs are higher and the sales prices are higher, and so, you know, they're not selling as many of those probably as they are on some of the cheaper tents, but the trend's there. It's absolutely there.
What are your thoughts on the technical super lightweight materials like the Cuban fiber? Because Ron was definitely not that impressed. He thinks a bit of a flash in the pan, he was telling me.
Yeah, well, you know, I kind of agree with him. Unlike Ron, we haven't gone down that road. I've stayed away from doing Cuban fiber for a couple of reasons. My biggest reason, frankly, is that it's just so expensive. It's 4 times the price, sort of wholesale price, to buy that fabric versus the silicone coated nylon we're using now. And at the end of the day, that adds, you know, a couple hundred dollars even or more to the price of a finished product. And I just don't want to go down that road. It doesn't sit right with me. And it's the kind of thing where my sort of gold standard for anything I do is, you know, would I buy it? Is this something that I would buy and use personally? And I have nothing against Cuban as a material. I mean, I think it performs reasonably well, provided you make sure you do things right in the manufacturing process. But it's the price. The price just I can't swallow the price for that fabric. So I've stayed away from it.
Yeah, I can understand that. Certainly, at the various trade shows I've been to, there have been a few Cuban fiber products, and they're always of great attraction at the show because they're the lightest or possibly the most expensive. But as you say, the bottom line is they're not a mass market product. You did the TGO challenge in 2010, of course. And I know you were using your Moment tent for that one. Now you've had experience of what would be probably a typical backpacking trip for a UK resident. What other people were using and how they were using it, has it convinced you that definitely Cuban fiber is just a step too far?
Well, I saw a handful of Cuban fiber shelters on that particular walk. I didn't actually kind of probe, you know, how's it going for you? How do you like this thing? How's it working for you? I think it seemed fine. I don't know what it's been. I don't know what it was like this year. I suspect there are probably more of them, but I'm not sure it's a step. I think if you do the right thing, the other problem with Cuban fiber that I didn't mention is not only is it more expensive to buy as a raw material, but you have to be very, very careful about how you sew and manufacture it into a finished good. It deals very poorly with, and this is true of all. It's sort of one of these dirty little secrets about fabrics that don't stretch. That sounds like a good thing, and generally it kind of is a good thing if you're worried about setting your tent up and not having it sag on you. But it's a bad thing with respect to point stresses. So a sudden gust of wind or you trip over a guy line or whatever puts a tremendous amount of force on the fabric. And fabrics that don't give, that you know, they either don't give or they rip. I mean, there's no in between. They don't stretch to relieve stress. So it's true with Cuban fibers. You have to be very careful about how you reinforce the stress areas on that fabric. And the other thing is with respect to seams is you have to be, you know, basically any seam under stress on a Cuban product opens up some pretty ugly looking seam holes. And so you have to basically seam tape all of the seams on a Cuban product, which adds a lot of labor and a lot of expense at the end of the day. So, I think once, if you manufacture correctly, so you tape the seams, you heavily reinforce the stress points, you know, I think Cuban's fine. I mean, I think it does the job. It's light. I would never ever use it for a floor. I think it has very poor abrasion resistance, but I think as a fly sheet kind of material, I think it's fine for that. So I don't know if that answers your question, but I have no doubt that more Cuban shelters showed up on the TGO this year than the year I did it. But beyond that,
well, it's certainly I think we're all being affected by the recession generally, and I wasn't under the impression a great amount more appeared in 2012, and obviously, of course, not many people would have seen them because they would have been inside their shelters, sheltering from the appalling weather. from all accounts. It's a cost element. I think that one of the major branded manufacturers have just brought one out, and it's £1,000, which is what, $1,500. Right. I mean, it's outrageous. But there again, you know, carbon fiber bikes sell well enough. Yep. So if people lust after them, they lust after them.
Carbon, carbon is also expensive, but carbon, because it's just less material than, you know, yards or meters worth of fabric, you can certainly make judicious use of carbon in tents, with some more expense, but not radically more expense. Carbon, I think, performs well, again, provided you've used it the right way. It is significantly lighter. It's quite strong. You have to be careful about how you stress carbon. But beyond that, I think that's a very viable material for tent products now.
Well, certainly, I think a lot of people aren't aware that certain carbon poles are actually alloy poles wrapped in carbon, which is giving you the benefit of two different types of materials there. But it's certainly the smaller, narrower tubes generally are pure carbon. And the biggest concern, I think, is when it freezes, it gets very, very brittle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that's by the way. What were your thoughts then on the TGO and the actual trip itself, and you know, mixing with us messy UK backpackers?
Yeah, I loved it. I thought it was a great experience for me. I tell you, the sweetest thing was the final dinner. And forgive me because I've forgotten the town name now.
But Montrose.
Montrose, thank you. The dinner at the end was just so sweet. It was such a camaraderie. It was such a family event at the end. And everybody, you know, stood up and everybody was introduced. There isn't quite the same thing here on our trails. You don't see that. I mean, you certainly see group trips, and they might have a group dinner at the end. But this sort of come together of people who've, you know, never met before, and then have a big family dinner for them at the end was a really sweet, sweet thing. I love that. That was great.
Excellent. You have your kickoff parties, which is, of course, at the other end.
But even that, it's a lot of people kind of milling around. There's no kind of, let's get up and let's just introduce all of ourselves to all of ourselves. That just doesn't happen at those those events.
All right. Oh, well, and the actual landscape itself, was there anything particularly challenging or came as a bit more of a surprise to you at all?
Well, it was pretty much what I expected. I hadn't been that particular part. I'd been to Scotland before, so I sort of knew kind of what was coming. I hadn't done that, of course, that route before. And this was an interesting trip for me, and this was the first time I'd ever used GPS. So, I bought a GPS unit. I got some maps. I had one marathon day here in front of my computer, just figuring out my whole route. Did the GPS route, plugged it into my GPS unit. When I got there, I turned the thing on, and I had backup paper maps for everything. And I don't think at no point did I ever look at a paper map. I followed my GPS screen the whole way, which was good, and it was bad. It was great because I always knew where I was. When it was foggy or rainy and I couldn't see anything, I followed the GPS. I was very confident in it. But on the other hand, I think it was a very different experience when you're following a GPS. You've sort of shut off that part of your brain that's really aware of its surroundings and kind of where am I now and where's that land point off in the distance. And, that sort of part of the experience sort of went away for me on this trip. It was different that way.
Yeah, I think you possibly missed out some of the social aspects as well, because I had a few people mention to me they met you, but you mm-hmm. came at them at right angles to the path they were on, and you routinely were sticking to your GPS, and they were saying, no, the path's this way, it goes around the other side. No, I've got to follow my GPS, and that was it. You were gone. All everybody saw was you going over the top of a hill.
That's true. But anyway, I love the experience. I really enjoyed the people. I will say it was a very different crowd than I'm used to. I'm used to a lot of, the lean, fast hiking crowd is sort of what I'm more used to. And this was there seemed to be a lot of retirees. A lot of people are just getting out for the joy of just walking a route at whatever pace they wanted to walk it. It's a very different experience than, the through hiking crowd out here was out to make every possible mile they can using every available moment of light and dark that they can. It's a very different thing.
Yeah, I think it's a very unique event. You have to take into account that for a lot of people, it is their big 2-week holiday of the year.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
As you say, the retirees, that sort of age range, it appeals to them most of all. And they have made lifelong friends through this particular event, and they only ever see them once a year when they bump into them on any top of a particular Munro or wherever they agree to. And I notice, in fact, somebody's put an advert up for a cheese and wine party and with a grid reference. So people are invited at certain times to cheese and wine parties halfway across. I mean, it gets ludicrous and extremely fun at the same time, you know?
Yeah, it was a great event. Someday I'm going to come back and do it again.
Yeah. I'm sure we'd love to see you. So, the lightweight, as you say, you're through hikers. You've definitely painted a picture there of the lightweight, or the top end or the extreme end of the lightweight fraternity, should we say, that are doing long distances and want to do them under with less weight and under great speed and so on. But is there more, more people, so we say, perhaps people with, back problems or knee problems or whatever that are coming back to hiking? Are they starting to take on board the development of the last sort of 5 or 10 years?
Well, I hear that. I hear customers or inquiries, people calling and emailing, asking those sorts of questions. Hey, I'm getting older. My knees don't work very well. I have a back problem. Whatever. I need some lighter gear. I definitely hear that as a trend. I think the trekking pole thing. I don't know how prevalent that is as a trend in Europe, particularly the UK. But trekking poles have just exploded here in the last few years, I think perhaps overexploded. I'm personally not a trekking pole user. I don't see the need, although I think when my knees go, I'll be a convert for now. But trekking pole, from a product perspective, we take an advantage of it. That a lot of our shelters use trekking poles for setup. And if you're already carrying your tent poles, it makes perfect sense to repurpose them. I mean, to use them for both purposes. I definitely see that the people have decided that they can get the same benefit and performance out of a lighter tent that they can out of their prior heavier tent, certainly.
Oh, well, certainly the trekking pole has established itself a long time ago here as being a very practical accessory for shedding the weight, sharing the load rather, and releasing the pressure on the pressure points. And as you say, it's a useful accessory to have then, and not have to carry additional poles for the tent as well, which has got to be good.
You're listening to the award-winning UK Business Podcaster of the Year.
The home of UK-based audio and video podcasts for lovers of the great outdoors everywhere.
Podcasts are based solely around self-powered travel.
This is The Outdoor Station.
Now, Ron did say that you guys tend to get together once a year and get together and go for a camping trip and share your new exciting toys. And that sounded very, very exciting. There was, I think you mentioned yourself and Glenn Van Pesky and who else? I'm sure you mentioned somebody else as well. The four of you get together and go for a hike?
We do, yeah. We try every year and do something. And the mixture, the makeup changes every year. Glenn couldn't make it this year. But we've had some other trips and, you know, it's not that we sort of share trade secrets, but we do generally have a chat sometime during the trip about, you know, materials. I'm going in together on materials purchases or, sharing sewing sources or, you know, we always have a bit of a laugh about certain customers who tend to shop all of us and, you know, some are better than others as customers, but, yeah, it's fun. We, you know, I'll tell you, all of us got into this because we were hikers or outdoor enthusiasts first, before we became gear makers.
Mm. Mm.
So, you know, it's a chance to, and you know, when you, I mean, there isn't a lot of glamour in what we do, honestly, most of the day. A lot of it is just typical business stuff, dealing with customers, dealing with manufacturing. I think all of us get out less than we would like because we're busy running the businesses.
Well, I can understand that. The irony of starting an outdoor business is you spend all the time indoors, which is which doesn't work. But no, it was just the this image that suddenly appeared in my mind of you guys sitting around getting very, very excited, like us all outdoors people do, going, I've got this. Where did you get that from? Where did that? Well, that's a good idea, and that isn't a good idea, you know.
Yeah. No, we all bring something, and we all kind of set it up, and then we kind of wait for someone else to comment.
Mine's shinier than yours. Mine's lighter than yours. Uh-huh. I could just imagine it'd be hours of endless fun. So what sort of things, how are things developing, do you reckon? You know, we've talked about the sort of materials, the Cuban fibres of this world, but is there something else on the horizon, do you think, that's going to be of interest to the outdoor industry and particularly with the lightweight industries as such as being something worth exploring, a new material or an aspect of lifestyle?
Well, I think we're all hoping for newer, shinier, lighter, cheaper materials. If there were a cheaper alternative to Cuban that performed, well, in some ways better. The seamstress things bother me on Cuban, but the, I'm not married to the fabrics I use. I would love to find a lighter, cheaper, at least a lighter and same price kind of alternative. And it's coming. I mean, you know, look at the history of the world, right? Things, it's all coming. It's just, I don't think any of us know exactly when. But yeah, I think we all keep our eyes open for new materials. I'll tell you what my dream fabric. I have this vision. I have a dream fabric that would be as light or lighter than what we're using now, as cheaper than we're using now, and it would have an integrated grid of electrical fibers that would be hooked up to some sort of infinitely renewable power source, cheap, light, free power source. It would keep the fabric warm all night. That you would eliminate condensation.
Oh, okay. But the word you used several times there was cheap, which, you know, that's nirvana, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, you're looking at your range just before we were speaking here, and it's really reassuring to see that you haven't really changed anything for what, the last 5 or 6 years, really. I mean, you've obviously tweaked things and perfected a few products, but your base products are still the same as they were when you first started.
Well, I don't think that's entirely true. We have 13 products now, 13 models, about to be 14 sometime this spring. And then, we started way back when, in 2001, I guess, with 2 products. So we have expanded the product line. So we started with a single and a double, and now we have a triple and a quad, and then a whole bunch more singles and a whole lot more doubles. But yeah, all we do is tents. I haven't expanded into packs or anything else.
Why not? Why haven't you been tempted to do that?
For me, I have to have a passion in whatever it is that I'm doing. And I honestly, I don't have much of a passion for other bits of gear. There's a couple of exceptions, but packs specifically, I don't have a passion for packs. To me, they all look like, bags with straps on them. Yeah, I don't get too excited about the aesthetics of a pack. I get very excited about the aesthetics of a tent, and so that kind of drives me. But packs, and you know, and so many people make packs, and there's nothing I can think of that I would bring to the party that would make the world better for packs. So that's why I don't do packs.
And I mean, your manufacturing's all in Seattle as well. Have you not been tempted to, you know, broaden the product volume and move to larger manufacturing over in Asia, as everybody else has done?
Yeah. So a while ago, I made a conscious decision to manufacture here in the U.S. for as long as I possibly could. So I'm sort of sticking with that original goal. It does limit our market, or it limits our ability to distribute, I'll say, because we manufacture here in the U.S. with almost exclusively U.S. materials. There's a few things we can't get here, zipper sliders and things, but most everything else we can get here, and it's made here. So our costs are high, our labor costs are high, our materials costs are high. But at the end of the day, we get a U.S. manufactured product, which I feel good about. And I think there's certainly a measurable component of our customer base that buys from us because we make stuff here. It's not an Asian made product. But it definitely limits us. We can't afford to play the retail game. So I couldn't sell to REI, for example. It just doesn't work. I'd be sending them tents and writing them checks at the same time.
Yeah. So you're balancing then continually, I presume, then that large enough to supply the market, but also big enough to be a practical business for the people you've got involved. But if you go too large, then you have to invest far too much money in all the different aspects before you even have
you do. It's a very different business. The retail world is a very different business. That's all about quantity, and I'm not interested in selling as many tents as I possibly can. I really enjoy the customer interaction because we're selling almost exclusively direct to the customer, as opposed to the retail model where you're selling to the distributor, you're selling to the store, and then the customer buys from the store, and then that's the store's customer. It's not really your customer anymore. So I actually prefer this model where we have direct customers. I have direct conversations and direct relationships with, you know, most everybody who's using our products. And I think at the end of the day, we get better feedback because of that. We get a lot more people, you know, we hear from saying, hey, I like this part or a bit about the tent, or I didn't like this bit about the tent. Can you change it? And so I think at the end of the day, it helps us with our product development.
Yeah, I think it's certainly a very warming feeling from both sides of the relationship, that you actually have a relationship and dialogue with the end user. I mean, we find the same thing ourselves with the items we manufacture. You know, as you say, the end user, the consumer is thinking, oh, that's a good idea. Well, and they don't feel shy about suggesting it to you as a modification. Many a thing has been incorporated to some of our products that way.
Yeah.
With over 1 million listeners worldwide, The Outdoor Station is the leading online audio resource for those into the great outdoors.
Now, it's been, 12 months now, I think, since Ryan Jordan wrote his piece, which I mentioned to Ron, about the, sort of the death of lightweight. And Ron wrote a fairly lengthy reply, which sort of shot down most of his points, I think. But it's been 12 months where a subject's been kicked around the internet generally. You've told me from your point of view where you stand and your thoughts from your business point of view, but how is the landscape looking across the arena, across the general lightweight user, whether they're a hiker or a cyclist? Is it still for everybody fairly buoyant about it, or do they, some of them tend to fall into that camp thinking it's all over and they're on to the next thing?
Yeah, that's a hard question to answer. I can certainly answer from our sales. I mean, I don't see any decline in our sales year over year, and this has been true for many years now. There doesn't seem to be any lack of interest among our customer base for lightweight products. There was an interesting thread, actually, not on BPL, but on another. It might have been backpacker.com. I read it quickly, but there was an interesting thread about the sort of like, you know, who out there has tried the lightweight thing and decided it's not for them and is just going back to whatever they were using before, which I thought was an interesting question because it sort of gets to your point about, you know, is this just a fad and now we've been there, done that, we're just going to go back to the way it was. And from what I read from those responses, there were certainly some people who were in that camp who'd said, yeah, I tried such and such a product and it, you know, it broke on me or it was too flimsy or you know, whatever. I didn't feel comfortable using it. And so it was sort of interesting to read those threads. But at the end of the day, I don't see any lull in the enthusiasm for lighter weight gear. That's not to say that there isn't some other way to do it that people would be even more enthusiastic possibly, But I think it's arrived to the point now where people are willing to acknowledge that you can get the same performance out of a lighter weight piece of gear. Mm. With caveat. So when you get into the really extreme stuff, the really lightweight, I'm just going to use Cuban as an example. It requires a bit more care. To protect your investment because you've spent a lot of money on your whatever it is. And so, and because of that, perhaps you might want to take more care in it because it cost you so much to begin with. Whereas, you know, a cheaper product, I broke it. It wasn't very expensive to begin with. I'll get something else.
I mean, the words that Ron was using was knowledge and education. I thought that was quite poignant, actually, that, you can't, certain materials, certain products may be very, very expensive and fall into a very light category, but you can't treat them the same way as you would do as a heavy-duty item. Yeah. And that knowledge and experience takes a while to gather, as well as put yourself in a situation where, you know, that particular item or article of clothing or whatever it may not be suitable for the type of activity you're doing.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I concur.
We've talked fairly extensively about, obviously, the US sales and US interest and so on. Have you noticed any development at all from the UK in regard to sales and interest, and also particularly from certain areas in mainland Europe at all? Because we're finding there's a lot more knowledge seems to be spreading into northern Europe and sort of France and Italy.
Yeah. So, well, I'd have to actually look at our sales data. My general sense year over year is that sales go up in Europe as they do here every year. I think probably our biggest European market is Germany. And then after that, it's probably the UK. And then, and we seem to be getting more, it's interesting, we've been getting more and more interest in the last couple years from Russia. Which kind of surprised me. The first Russian order we got, I was like, whoa, this is from Russia. But it's been happening with some frequency these days. And I don't know, I don't know what that means. Maybe it seems people have just more disposable income in Russia now, or if there's actual a growing hiking market in Russia, or if those two are somehow coming together. I don't know, but the Russian orders sort of surprised me, have continued to surprise me. France and Italy, yes. France is somewhere below the UK. Italy is not common for us. We sell a few to Italy, but it's not common.
One thing, I mean, it seems to the common thread for us seems to be that somebody, an enthusiast, will buy a product or what series of products or whatever else, and they obviously mention it on their particular forum that they're involved in, and then all of a sudden you get a cluster of sales from that country or that area.
Yeah, that happens a lot to us now these days from Hong Kong. There seems to be some hiking activity, hiking clubs that go on in the Hong Kong area. So that, yeah, we see that as well.
Well, I was over in Hong Kong myself at the beginning of this year, 2012, and my goodness me, hasn't the country come on since the last time I was there, which was probably about 15, 20 years ago. It really has moved forward in a big way. And yet I was sad enough to drag my wife and go around all the outdoor shops I could possibly find in Hong Kong and over into China. And it was interesting to see the brands and items that were for sale. Some of the brands that seemed to have the most penetration were German brands.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was quite interesting. It's definitely more the alpinist type equipment. And then you had the sort of the stoves. Serious brand names on the stoves. So there's obviously an interest in quality products that these stores were selling. But the other end of the marketplace, though, they didn't have any own brands which actually were of better than basic quality, which may be the answer to the question, really, and to your point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've never been to Hong Kong. It's a place I'd like to go. That's an interesting observation on your part.
What about your trips? I mean, you've got a young family now, and I know how difficult that can be to allow you to get out and play. But have you got any trips left on your list of walks you'd like to do?
Well, yeah, as a on a continental perspective, I would love to go spend some time in South America, walk in the Andes, and down into the Patagonia region. And there's lots of I don't know a lot about South America, but it's a place I would love to go and have some time to walk. And we've actually talked as a family about perhaps doing a sabbatical year in South America somewhere. That's a few years down the road, but that would give us an opportunity to go explore the Andes. Closer to home, I mean, I get out and do a fair amount of day walking around where we live. We live sort of generally in the Lake Tahoe region of California Sierra. So the northern Sierra is all pretty accessible for us, for me, sort of within an hour and a half drive to a lot of places. And so that's sort of, I can get away for day hikes. Longer trips are difficult with the business and the family. But I've seen a lot of the Sierra in my past life. Just, there's nothing quite like the Sierra that I've ever seen anywhere else. It's a special place. And there's some places that I've seen in the Sierra that it never gets old to go back to them.
Sounds lovely. Well, I must make a point of coming over there at some stage and visiting. I'd definitely like to see that myself. In fact, I noticed on your product videos, I was just looking at them amazed, and I've never seen so much dry ground, particularly at the moment. It's just absolutely sodden here. And so do you take all your tents up to, your shelters up to a particular place to pitch for those videos?
So those setup videos are actually taken in a little clearing in the forest, about a few hundred meters really from our shop, from our house. they're very close by.
Well, let's finish off with a bit of fun then. You obviously get out when you can, and you have your get-togethers with the rest of the guys there, where you, I presume, sit and brag like the rest of us do and about your new toys and things. But more than fascinated to know, you have your own products on naturally, but what have you actually paid for? What's in your rucksack that you've paid for, and what is your rucksack?
What have I paid for? So, well, I can tell you my pack. My pack is a a ULA pack. I believe it's the Catalyst model. I did pay for that, although I didn't have to, but I paid for it. I like that pack a lot. What else have I paid for? Well, of course, various clothing bits I paid for. I don't know, jackets and pants and hats and gloves and those kinds of things. My sleeping bag actually is, I made that for myself. It's a down quilt, and that's probably my favorite piece of gear. That works for anything other than serious winter. Maybe just because I put so much labor into that quilt, that's my favorite piece of gear.
Did you use that on the TGO as a matter of interest?
I did, yeah. Yep.
I'd love to talk to you a bit more about quilts, actually, because it's something that I've been pursuing and trying myself over the last 12 months. And the weather's been against me. But I find that when I use the quilts, they're actually considerably warmer than you'd anticipate them being.
Yeah, so I found that there's no reason you have to be cold in a quilt, but I do find that it takes a certain technique. You have to know how to roll up in them when the weather's cold. I mean, because the beauty of the quilt, of course, is it drapes over you, and so you don't get so hot. I was often way too hot in a traditional zip up the bottom sleeping bag, and so I would always unzip it anyway and just lay it over me as a quilt. So, given that I always did that, I was like, what's the point of having the zipper if I'm not going to use it? So that sort of got me started on the quilt thing. But you know, on the flip side, when it is cold, you want to be wrapped up in your quilt. So that it took me a little while to figure out how to do that, because the quilt's not huge to begin with. I probably, in retrospect, could have made it just a little bit wider. But yeah, I've learned how to use it. I've survived nights that were quite chilly in that quilt.
And what's sort of the construction? I presume it's a down construction. Have you got a foot box in it? And is there some sort of
box, baffled,
straps underneath to wrap it
and
to the...
I put in one strap to sort of hold the edges to the pad or underneath the pad. Just sort of cinch it up against the pad, sure.
Is that a dog you've got in the background there?
Yeah.
And do you... What's the sleeping pad you use there?
So I have a number of pads. The one I'm currently using is a inflatable from POE, Pacific Outdoor something or other.
Yeah.
Enterprises, whatever it is.
Is it the Peak Elite?
I don't know. I bought it for the TGO. So right. I'm not sure it's manufactured anymore. It does have some thermal, it's a thermo-etho, something like that. It does have some thermal insulation in it, and that's performed well for me. I've been pretty happy with that pad. And I just, you know, again, for me, it was like, well, I could do that, or I could get the hyper-expensive Thermarest, whatever their inflatable, lightweight inflatable pad is. But at the end of the day, this one was about a third the cost, and it's performed just fine for me, so I'm happy with it.
When you referring to your clothes and the insulation in your clothes, are you a down or a Primaloft person from that point of view?
So I actually don't carry either, unless it's winter, in which case the equation changes. But for everything else, I carry layers. I got to be a big fan of my wool pullover top, long sleeve shirt. And then I have, you know, layers of polypropylene or whatever it is, and then of course the shell jackets on top of that. So I'm a layer sort of person, just pull on and off layers as needed, but not so much insulated layers, except if it's winter.
Right, and that you manage with that okay in Scotland?
Yeah, just fine. I tend to be warm. When I'm walking, I get quite warm, and I have to take off layers just to not overheat and get too sweaty.
Yeah. Well, see, that's because you're moving so fast. That's what it comes down to. And what about your cooking equipment then? What's your preference for cooking stove and material and pans and whatever?
Yeah, so actually on the TGO was the first time I'd ever used a canister stove, because I couldn't come over on the plane with any sort of fuel, so I had to buy the fuel there. And so I ended up picking up one of those, whatever it is, propane, butane, canister stoves.
Yeah.
which for the CGO worked beautifully. It was just easy and quick, and I didn't worry about it. I don't use that kind of thing here generally, just because I think there's sort of a waste. I'm not sure what you do with the canister when you're done, and of course there's the canister weight. But for most things around here, I use alcohol, or preferably actually the solid fuel tablets, stove setups, which I found pretty workable. You can't simmer with them, of course, but if all you want to do is boil water, they work well. I did have one scary alcohol experience a few years ago where I kicked over my alcohol stove, and you know, and the alcohol goes everywhere and the flames go everywhere and you can't put it out. It's not a good thing. So I've sort of stayed away from alcohol ever since, and I've gone back to just to the solid fuel tablets.
And what do you use? What do you put the solid fuel tablets into? Have you got a particular type of stove?
Yeah, no, I have a little homemade holder, I guess, for the tablet. And then I use a cone, a caldera cone. I don't know if you're familiar with those. It's a little conical looking piece of aluminum, and it doubles as a windscreen and a pot holder. So that sort of wraps the whole enclosure and provide some efficiency for the burning process.
Oh no, they're well used by a lot of people here, certainly, and very very effective heat source, definitely. So my final question, as always, a bit of a low ball. Of all the things I could have asked you, what should I have asked you?
Ah yes, well I love hearing from customers, rants and raves. If you look up on our website under gallery, all of those are unsolicited, and testimonials, all of those are unsolicited. People who just write in, send testimonials, or send photos from really great places they've been with our tents. I love that kind of stuff. And I like hearing rants too, because it frankly makes us come up with better products. It forces us to improve what we're doing. So if you have something we're doing and you don't like it, and let us know why. It helps us make better tents.
Brilliant. Well, thanks very much indeed for your time. It's been wonderful talking to you again, Henry, and I wish you all the very best for 2013 and beyond.
You too. Thanks very much.
My thanks to Henry for taking the time to talk and add more to this interesting topic. In my next interview, I'll be seeking the thoughts of Glenn Van Pesky, head honcho over at Gossamer Gear, another company who has stuck to its lightweight core and is very much a positive online influence in all things lightweight. As it will be the final one in this short series, we'll also discuss some of the feedback I've been receiving since posting the first podcast, including, isn't it time to drop the various category headings and just share the love out on the hills? And on that thought, we'll continue this discussion next time. Take care now. Bye for now.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To hear more from our extensive free library, please visit the website at theoutdoorstation.co.uk.
You can now follow The Outdoor Station on Facebook, where we chat about each programme we produce, answer questions, and discuss future productions. Why not join us there?
This podcast is produced and hosted by theoutdoorstation.co.uk.